Welcome to the Marketing Update. It is Friday, February 22nd. We're coming to you from HubSpot in Cambridge, and I'm Mike Volpe.
And I'm Laura Fitton.
And we got a bunch of cool stuff to talk about this week. Let's start off with Twitter lowering the length of tweets.
Like 140 wasn't short enough.
Right, and now it's like getting a little shorter and shorter. So basically, the T.co link wrapper, the Twitter link wrapper that they put around all the links so they can get some analytics and tracking on the links that you're putting into your tweets, have gotten a little bit longer.
They needed more real estate, probably because they need more unique identifiers. Most link shorteners, when they first started to take off 4 or 5 years ago, were really short, and then over time added another character to the hash, the part at the end that makes it unique. So it's probably just deriving from that. And Mike, we only lost 2 characters.
Just 2 characters?
Less than
2%. It's not a big deal. Right?
I might have had to go back and rename my company 138, but wouldn't have been the end of the world.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you're using a link, you have 117 characters in which to write your tweet. I would just say, if you're a marketer and you do have a lot of tweets already scheduled in your software, go through and do a quick check and make sure none of them are going to break.
And I would also say that, yes, you should do that check, but in reality, you shouldn't be cramming the entire space full. The optimal length for a tweet is really, I would say leave at least like 20 characters, because then when people go to retweet it old school, or they want to make a short comment and retweet it or things like that, you're allowing some space for that to happen. So I think you get more retweet activity if you allow a little extra space. So don't cram it totally full. Like, you don't have to use all those characters. And I would say if you're looking to get some retweet action, you actually would want to leave some space.
Yeah, honestly. So think of it as 97 characters that you have in which to your writing. And also just get really, really damn good at copywriting. It's like headline writing. Some of the shortest tweets are some of the most popular, not even because of retweet space, but because they get to the point.
There you go. Cool. All right, so there's a few tips on that. Next up, we have a cool thing. So there's an agency out of the UK at fastcocreate.com that created the articles in fastcocreate.com. Yep. We'll have a link for you. A tube rank app, which
really,
is basically showing you
really smart
information about different viral videos and kind of what caused them to go viral or what the factors are that made them interesting to different audiences, things like that. Pretty interesting. Did you play with it at all?
I haven't played with the tool yet, and that's the big outstanding question. I mean, this is potentially a quantum leap from like, oh, cute kid or cute puppy or something crazy, you know, or as the headline in Fastco Create says, LOL plus WTF equals money. To something a little more scientific, assuming it works and assuming it can tease out meaningful factors, their idea is not so much that it's going to tell you how to make a video go viral, as you'll be able to review a bunch of related things and kind of break down what about it seems to have tipped the point. And they do have a lot of really interesting variables in there to help you figure that out. Who's sharing it where, in what context?
Totally. I play with it a little bit. I want to go a little bit deeper. I think the struggle that I had for it was we know our persona really well that we sell to. And there wasn't a good way to say, like, okay, put our persona, Marketing Mary, put our persona in here, and what are the things that have done well there? It was more they had these different factors between LOL, WTF, and cuteness, and like other things that you would say, like, how important those are, you think, to your audience. And then different kind of industry topics that were very consumer centric. So there's like, you know, there's gaming and other things, but there was nothing really about, you know, there was music and other travel and things like that, but nothing about business topics. So it was really hard as kind of more of a B2B marketer to be able to use this thing to figure out, okay, but the concept of the tool I thought was really cool, and the idea of it is cool, and I wonder if they're going to be able to take a little bit further, where if I could go in and say, okay, well, for this audience of people, what's been successful with them, that to me would be super, super helpful. I just don't know that they really, if they'll ever get to sort of that point, but the idea of it is very, very cool, and it's certainly a fun thing to play with a little bit.
Definitely.
If not, I would say though, the even if it doesn't have the right things for you to filter down to your audience, the one thing that you could do is just kind of make some educated guesses, and then it does sort of unsurface for you videos that have gone viral. So it's a good place to sort of say, okay, what are some of the top viral videos with some sort of a sorting and filtering mechanism? And they have like, they show you sort of one, but then they have a few other suggestions just below it. So you can kind of see 3, 4, 5 videos kind of for each topic. And just watching a bunch of them, I think, just helps you sort of figure out what types of things tend to go viral.
Well, and the biggest challenge with viral video, especially if you're a really good inbound marketer, because inbound marketing has a lot to do with segmenting down to the right audience. So viral amongst whom? Do you think it that will help marketers address that concern?
Maybe. I think that the sort of the segmentation and the sort of profiles that they have built into the tool aren't granular enough to really sort of be effective there. And I think that part of it is like some of the data is just not available. And, you know, so I think that's really going to be the challenge there. But perhaps. But again, I think that's the whole point around, I mean, it's like viral with whom, right? So it's like if you have a video that only gets 50 or 100,000 views, but those are like the most important people that you're trying to reach out to, that can be really, really effective versus getting 500,000 views from college students if you don't have anything to sell to college students.
Right.
So that's definitely an important thing to think about. Next up, we got
related to the for whom question.
Exactly.
ESPN, incredibly popular sports radio properties, just took a quantum leap in terms of how targeted the advertising that goes out on those properties can be. And what I loved about this is that, you know, I'm the inbound marketing evangelist, right? It's in my job title. I love it when things that were outbound can be more inboundy. And I think better, more effective targeting like this makes even advertising, the ultimate outbound move, kind of inboundy.
Yeah, if it's used right. Right?
If used correctly, right.
I think that what they've done is they've enabled you to do much finer segmentation and targeting, even down perhaps to like an individual person of the ads that you're getting when you're listening to the radio stream on your mobile device typically. Sort of cool. And the article goes really to a large point of like saying that this is totally brand new. I thought Pandora and things like Pandora were kind of already doing this. But apparently not. Apparently, it's still the segmentation and targeting that you can get with those tools is still relatively broad.
Blunt.
I mean, I know, you know, it's you definitely get location-based stuff. So you'll get things around, you know, Boston or even actually more. I've heard one that was actually a town outside of Boston that wasn't far from where I lived. I was like, okay, that's interesting. But apparently, even Pandora isn't doing this level of targeting. So it'll be interesting to see what people do with this.
And it's on a massive scale. I mean, ESPN is a marquee mainstream media property. Yeah. So, you know, as the article kept raising the point, this article ran on adweek.com. It had really been kind of drastically underserved in terms of what they were able to do with an audience that big and that engaged, because sports audiences are literally, by definition, fanatical. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the other takeaway, in addition to, like, if you're doing this type of stuff, this is probably one thing that you want to look at. But the other takeaway would be you still want to be the content, not the ads interrupting the content. And if you could create your own podcast about sports for sports fans, right? Like we have customers that sell, you know, all sorts of products related to sports. What they would want to do is have a podcast or other, you know, blogging, you know, whatever else that's attracting that audience themselves. And then you own all of the content, not just the ads that are interrupting other people's content. But if you want to look into that kind of stuff, this is definitely a good leap forward in terms of the technology that's available.
And if it's targeted that well, I think you start to get the opportunity to, yes, the content's going to be interrupted. People are used to that. Interrupt it in a productive way, right?
Yeah.
If you know you're targeting women of a certain age, you know, maybe, now I'm going to be all sexist here, right? Maybe you can give, like, primer on, you know, football basics or something like that, right? So I'm thinking about what I would need. A lot of women are more avid sports fans than me and wouldn't need that. But if you're targeting really well, I think the chance that your interruption can actually be useful and relevant and wanted goes up a little bit.
Totally. It's you have a better chance of being valuable to the end user.
Right.
Marketing Land had an interesting story with a bunch of data on Pinterest and Instagram, sort of very visual content focused social networks, I think is maybe one way to categorize those folks.
I like to call them Pinstagram.
Pinstagram, yeah. Yeah, although, yeah, yeah, it is funny because they do, like, they're both very visually content focused, but Pinterest is about other people's visual content and you sharing and collecting that. Instagram is really a kind of next generation photo app, but
they're totally different. That's just kind of my get off my lawn, old lady remark about, oh, new photo sharing. Yeah, Pinstagram.
Totally.
But they really are being used by marketers in serious numbers. Mm-hmm. I mean, 59% of top brands are active on both. They're nip and tuck right behind Google Plus in terms of most dominant business used social networks. Although I have to confess, I'm not very Google Plus savvy either.
Yeah.
But you know, it's there were some interesting numbers in here. One number that didn't really surprise me at all, and I almost was like, why are they even bothering to mention this, is this idea that brands sharing on Instagram, 98% of them also push it out on their Facebook page. I mean, well, duh, isn't that the whole reason Facebook bought Instagram?
Right.
And of course, they also pointed out that since December, when Twitter shut Instagram out of Twitter cards and that instant display of the photo, brands sharing their Instagram images to Twitter have declined quite a bit, also 59%. Coincidentally, which I double checked to make sure it wasn't a typo.
Yeah. It, I think what the other thing is, it said that the amount of sort of engagement, so for things that were making its way from those images onto Twitter, it was about 22 tweets per photo, but Facebook is bringing in sort of, you know, they measure engagements, which can be, you know, likes or shares or different things, but it's more like 274 per photo. So it seems like there was a higher level for these brands of engagement happening with visual content on Facebook versus Twitter, which I think is true because Twitter is, well, A, they're blocking the Instagram photo cards, but B, even for other visual content, you have to kind of click into it to get it on Twitter. Like in your mainstream, it's not there, right? Whereas Facebook, that's like, that's what stands out in your stream on Facebook is those visual images. So visual content is critically important to Facebook. You get a lot more engagement if you use visual content. Twitter, I still think, you mentioned this earlier, a lot of it is about copywriting and headline.
Yeah. And you know, I call a little bit BS on this, you know, tweets per photo versus Facebook engagement per photo, because there's a lot of other things you do with a tweet besides retweet it or tweet about it.
Yeah.
You like it, you reply to it.
Could click on the link in it.
You favorite it. Well, sorry, I said like, I meant favorite. The numbers, it looked like it's a 10 to 1 ratio, but I'm not sure they're equivalent.
There's apples to oranges there, yeah, absolutely.
You know, apples, oranges, you make a nice
smoothie. But I think there you go. But I do think we would both say that visual content, critically important for Facebook, probably a little less important for Twitter, but visual content overall, very important.
And the engagement right on Instagram itself, even before the brand shares it out, is incredibly high. Engagement per photo of 4,816. And that's a quarter over quarter jump of 31%. So definitely a hot platform if you're not using it yet for your business. Worth looking around at what some other companies are doing and seeing if you find something that you think you can glom onto.
Totally. Okay, next up we've got a new startup that we thought was a little bit interesting to talk about. We normally don't cover like every new startup because there's a lot of them, but Vurb, V-U-R-B.
V-U-R-B, not the verb, but Vurb.
Now, maybe Vurb actually dreams someday that their name becomes a verb.
Could you Vurb that for me, please?
Yes, that would be, I mean, just like, would you Google that? I think
that's
probably what they
want. Let
me Vurb
that for you.
Maybe Vurb wants to be a verb, but we digress. So
they've got an amazing lineup of investors. Yeah. I look at this list: Max Levchin, Drew Houston, Naval Ravikant, Brad Garlinghouse, the author of the famous Peanut Butter Manifesto at Yahoo years ago. I mean, they definitely, Atlas Venture, our neighbors upstairs in the building
CRV,
here.
Who's one of the shareholders in HubSpot.
The Crunch Fund, and, you know, Arrington's hard as hell to impress. So clearly the folks in the Valley think they've got something going here. They're calling it a contextual content engine. And the big picture idea, as I understood it, was, you know, for 20 years we've been clicking around the web and like going to a site, and every site, the data is formatted differently and we consume it very differently depending on what site it is. And they're trying to kind of bring that all together and bring in data from LinkedIn, Yelp, Google Maps, Amazon. Nothing quite like Vurb exists on the market, they're saying.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. They're sort of in stealth mode right now, which is interesting. You have an article written about your financing and what your vision is, but it'd still be in stealth mode. Not sure what that means, but it's cool to be in stealth mode again. So you definitely want to be in stealth mode now. I think it's become
stealth
cool
is
again.
For fighter jets.
Yeah,
I think Dharmesh has that one right.
Yeah, but
they're saying they're going to connect all the places you visit online for content, and the place where you can collect and cross-reference this information. So I'm picturing something where I see content from all those types of sites, but it's somehow been unified into a relevant format that I can refer to. I mean, I don't freaking know. It's stealth.
And it seemed like they sort of talked about it that it might be like organized around use cases. So like you have a business dinner coming up, and what are the things you need to know for business dinner? Well, you need some research on the person's background, and that might come from LinkedIn or other types of searches, right? You need to find a good restaurant that is recommended for that type of you know, that type of dinner. So you don't want something too romantic, but you don't want something too loud where you can't have a conversation, right? So it's like, okay, what are the restaurants that are in a certain area, maybe near someone's office, that meet that criteria and have good reviews on Yelp, right? Then, you know, maybe you need parking, maybe you need directions. Like, you need all these things as part of this one activity, and they're trying to put all this stuff in one place and make it easier and better. I think the big question here will be, if they're really going to be pulling in content from all those other places, most of those people make money off of advertising around their content. How is that going to work? And is Verb going to try to, like, take the content? They have their own advertising or something. And how is that? Are they going to pay, you know, some advertising dollars back to those people because they're using their content? Like, how's that going to work? I mean, there's always been, Google has tried to do some small things like this
to pull content
into search results.
Yep.
And a lot of times people resist that for good reason.
Yeah, I mean, that's always, I remember having a person very involved with a travel online site that had such a love-hate relationship with Google, right? Because they depended on their traffic, and yet Google was pulling in their reviews, and it was all very messy, and everybody had leverage over everybody. And so for a relatively small startup, I mean, this is a very modest round size, especially to be getting the coverage it's getting.
Yeah.
$1.5 million, they're looking to double their team with that. Companies these days have been raising these crazy rounds, so I actually think that's really interesting that it's not an obscenely, like, huge, I mean, I actually think it's good.
And
they've launched their invite-only beta, and, you know, the first 500 people who use this link, use the link, it's probably still going to work. Those first 500 things are always BS. They were for me. Don't tell.
Don't tell anyone. Awesome.
Create the illusion of scarcity. So Verb, let's see what happens with Verb.
Riffing off of that, like, cool ways to launch something of having the invite-only exclusive thing.
Sure.
Next up, we've got Google Glass.
I got my HubSpot glass because, you know, I'm not cool enough to have Google Glasses
yet. $1,500. Much more affordable. Also available.
Oh, my God. All the context on you, it's spewing right now. Totally. I didn't even want to know that, man. That's my boss. I don't want to know.
Totally. So, in any event, Google Glass, for those of you who have been buried underneath a carpet or the sand or something, is this new product from Google. They talked about it about a year ago as this, like, experimental sort of, like, futuristic thing. And to be honest, I thought it was going to be years. I thought it was a vision, kind of like a concept car thing. And it was going to be years, like years before it came. Doesn't appear to be true. It actually seems like they're going to be launching relatively soon.
We love the orange.
A thing that you wear with a little tiny monitor on it with voice control that responds to the world around you. And you can tell it to take a photo, you can publish to social media, you can record stuff, you can theoretically, like, as you're looking at things, it will show you contextual information related to the things you're looking at and where you are. Very, very fascinating idea of adding a layer of interaction to the world, and especially taking the web from this thing that you use a computer or mobile device to interact with and just interweaving it into, you know, you and your daily life. Getting to the point of, like, the web, you know, the Wi-Fi microchip being implanted in your brain, kind of like, you know, futuristic vision, right, of having all the power of the web, like, instantly accessible. This is, like, a step in that direction. Really, really interesting. But I think what we mostly wanted to talk about was the marketing aspect of this, of, like, how do they launch it?
Right.
So what'd they do?
Right. Well, they made people like us desperately want a pair, and we are shamelessly retweeting you right now.
I know.
Because we want that first pair. You know, we want to be among those first, is it 8,000?
I think it was 8,000 people that are going to do an early launch with.
Yep.
It's $1,500.
You apply to it.
You apply by sharing in social.
You hope like hell you get it. Yep. You share in social.
So that drives their social metrics. You hope like hell you get it. They're going to pick people that tend to be more creators and sharers. So the people that will be talking about the experience a lot more and will spread sort of the idea of Google Glass.
These could be you.
Exactly. All this stuff. So they're being very, very smart about the launch. They had a very good video that sort of explained how it worked in a very aspirational way and sort of like, wow, that would be so cool if I had those. And there's been just a ton of activity around it. It was a trending topic on Twitter. There's you know, a lot happening with this, and they've done a really, really good job of launching it. It remains to be seen of sort of like what happens. If you want to support the case for me to be one of the first people to get Google Glass, and I will do whatever cool things
we
people come
share,
up with their ideas.
Yeah, one idea
would be to have, like, random hangouts and talk about marketing, right? Because you can do a Google Hangout from, like, right there. That would be cool. Or maybe give people, like, an insider view of a bunch of things that happen at HubSpot, like, from my perspective. That could be cool. I will have a link from mikevolpe.com/glass that goes to the tweet that I posted about this. So people, if they want to retweet that and be part of the HubSpot Google Glass experiment, that would be cool. I think it's unlikely we'll get it. I think they're going for much more of a consumer audience, but I think it would be interesting to have a few people as part of the 8,000 that have more of a B2B take on this whole thing and see if it could be used for B2B. I think that would be cool. So Google, if you're listening, hook us up.
We're right there with you. And I also want to give some shout out to CNET.com. They did a very good job of digesting down what's awesome about this launch. They have developers out in the world already trying to figure out what kind of apps to build for this, so that when it does launch, those apps will already be available. Stark contrast to what Apple did with the iPhone, teasing developers for 2 years before they even launched an SDK. There was rumors of an SDK. They have evangelists, not just people like us, you know, flogging our social channels to try and get this thing, but Diane von Furstenberg's show on, you know, during New York Fashion Week, and Sergey Brin walking around the world kind of wearing his all the time, so that people, when they do paparazzi shots of him, they have it right in there. So, you know, great job, and good luck with winning the mainstream, because obviously there's a lot of skeptical out there behind walking around with, like, nerdy, like,
A part of the success of this product will definitely be making geek chic truly acceptable to the world. Like, there's people that pretend to do, like, the geek chic thing, but this is like, you have a weird Star Trek-looking, like, thing on your face, and you need to kind of get over that. I mean, I would be psyched to wear these, but I'm very sure, like, my wife would be, like, looking at me like, you're going to wear that?
If I were them, I would add to the groups they're courting, I would add kind of the maker subset, the people with the 3D printers who do really creative things, and do contests around different looks, because the look of Google Glass is going to make a huge difference. You know, once they can get to the point where they've modularized the two critical parts and the rest of it can kind of be tweaked, I think that could be really interesting.
Totally. There's some other things we wanted to talk about. Sort of news this week, but we kind of wanted to go a deeper dive on a couple things. One was...
So I was in my Jeep, and I was going through the drive-thru at Burger King. And, you know, both Jeep and Burger King got hacked on Twitter. It turned out to be hacked with kind of a small H. This wasn't a particularly difficult thing, or at least we can infer that from circumstantial evidence. The circumstantial evidence being Twitter's own blog post, which basically says, hey, brands, make difficult passwords, and also don't be stupid. They were a little more diplomatic than
otherwise
that.
Otherwise, a DJ in Rhode Island.
It looks like a DJ in Rhode Island.
Numerous levels, by the way.
Who has, like, I'm sure, like, he plays events here in Boston, and his events, you know, iThug. And there were, you know, he did not even try and cover his footprints. The tweets shout out to iThug, and that's a known thing. And he was part of this hacking group way back when that did this other famous hack, and But, you know, come on, brands, like, please. A couple of points relevant to you as a marketer. Jeep did a much better job than Burger King when they did resume control of their account of mopping it up quickly. Like, Burger King immediately flipped. It had been flipped to McDonald's branding. So Burger King flipped the branding back, but left up all the caustic, obnoxious tweets for another 3 hours. Like, hello, who's asleep at the wheel there? On the other hand, massive influx of followers from this on both accounts.
Totally. More than 10,000 new followers for each of them. Like, really, really interesting that it's one of those things. It's topical. And at least I think the tweet quality from the hacker declined over time. But some of the initial ones were sort of clever and funny. And there was, like, you know, sort of interesting. And that, again, it attracted some attention. It attracted a lot of attention to the accounts. People started to follow them. And it remains to be seen, like, I mean, I think Burger King did sort of, like, welcome their new followers from this interesting incident. So maybe the whole thing is just sort of a publicity stunt or something. Or maybe people try this as a publicity stunt, which leads us to a next part of this thing you
and
want to bring
so
up.
So in response, MTV and BET said, hey, let's Freaky Friday this. Let's switch places. So they pretended that their accounts had
been hacked
and turned into each other and, you know. I thought that was pretty good on-the-spot thinking, kind of up there with the Oreos dipping in the dark thing from the Super Bowl. There were some commentators who said, oh, God, they're so lucky they didn't get a backlash from that, or, oh, that's now put them in the crosshairs of hackers who are going to come after them. But this was not a particularly, again, not a particularly sophisticated hack. It looks like it was a password guess either directly on the Twitter account itself. Lots of jokes going around there about, like, oh, Whopper 123 probably wasn't the best idea. Or it was a password guess on an email account, and they used a password reset queue. I have to say, one of my pet peeves about passwords is that when the developers make them so complicated, like it's got to have exclamation point, capital, and a letter, it's like, I don't want to give my banking level security password to the latest Twitter app that's going to check for unfollows, you know? So I hope developers make passwords more human. And I'll insert for you, the marketer, a really memorable way that I make passwords, because as you know, I have a horrible memory. I write something just bizarre and funny, and you know, a couple words together, and then every time I type it, I'm kind of giggling inside, which is nice. And I shared that on Twitter this week, and I heard some really interesting ideas. Some people make their passwords something pertaining to a life goal, so it becomes like a mantra every time they write it. I write something funny and absurd and ludicrous. You know, others have different ways of approaching it. So sometimes a couple natural language words strung together in a random way with a few numbers thrown in is going to be much easier for you to remember and much harder for a hacker to hack.
I will say, I think if you're a big brand and you have a huge amount of following, you need a, I would say, a super secure password. I've already chatted with our team about making our password. It was pretty secure before, but even like more secure. And like, yes, I understand it's harder to remember, but there's just a lot. I mean, you know, we have 400,000 followers. It's a lot of risk.
Some of the early punditry on the case too suspected that this maybe was a disgruntled person who had access to the password.
Also something you need to worry about. Changing them on a regular schedule as well.
Change them on a regular schedule, but also use a lot of tools, kind of the, you know, the nuclear plant thing where your hands are in a glove and the gloves are touching the uranium. Use a lot of tools where the people updating the accounts don't ever need to know your password, right? Because they're authorized on a tool and you have control to deauthorize them when the correct time comes.
Yeah.
That's the more effective corporate way to do it.
Yeah, there you go.
So we had some big news here at HubSpot this
week. Did we? What happened?
Well, you know, we talked pretty openly, because we are one of the world's most transparent companies, about what our revenue picture looked like in 2012.
Yep.
What I would love to hear from you, our CMO, is sort of how you took that nugget of data, basically, and made it into actual news that's useful for other people to read. Because other people don't care how much money we do or don't make.
Well,
they want to know what's the significant trend in the software industry.
Our investors probably care how much money we make, but they know. They know.
But
no,
our
you're
investors
right.
aren't the
I
readership
think,
of the
no,
places
no,
that
no,
pick
no,
the
no.
story.
And they get lots of information that we don't publicly broadcast every single week or month. So I think this is a little bit of an example around, I mean, we just had, this news just came, we sort of just published this news this morning, and we've already had a blog article, The Wall Street Journal, Boston Business Journal, I think Inc., and like a few others. And it's one of those cases where, as a marketer, what you always want to do is try to create things that are newsworthy. And a lot of times people don't think about like the progress of the numbers involved in their business as being newsworthy, but they can be if they're decent. And especially if you can tie them into like broader trends. Like the Wall Street Journal article wasn't, you know, just like, oh, well, HubSpot had this much revenue and HubSpot. It was about, oh, well, the marketing is changing. Marketing technology spending is growing. And here's an evidence of that, which is HubSpot's revenue was up 82%. So they're talking about this broader trend, which ties into publicly traded companies, other private companies, and something that their audience would be more interested in. So I think that's one aspect of it. The other thing is we didn't just come out with a press release. We actually put all this stuff together into a SlideShare presentation, which we've done for a couple years. It wasn't new this year. We've done that type of a thing. But there's sort of some visual content there that gives you a lot of detail, a bunch of different numbers, and then of course there's, you know, a couple of the headline numbers that come out of that and typically get the coverage. But we tried to make an interesting piece of content out of this data to help build sort of a larger news story. And this is, I think more companies are starting to do things like this. MailChimp had a pretty cool annual report this year. That was theirs is very well designed. It's very, very graphical. You have this page, you scroll down as you get to different sections, like the colors change, it gives you both business and performance and random facts, like the number of pizzas that they ordered for the company and things like that. So there's other examples of people doing things like this, but it can be a helpful and useful technique.
Excellent.
Yeah, cool. So I think we wanted to wind down the show. You had a couple shout outs you wanted to make.
I did. I think one of the things that excites me the most about being at HubSpot is with the amazing employees, the amazing customers, what they're doing. So I want to congratulate Anam Hussein, who, my God, it seems like she was just an intern, right? Like, she has just torn up things, you know, really, really amazing woman, works really, really hard. She was featured in USA Today For the story of how she went about getting a job here and how she really, really hustled for it. So,
and she actually created an ebook of the reasons why we should hire her and then sent us that. And we're like, oh, well, we like to create ebooks, so that was a good idea.
Nothing like walking our walks. Totally. And guess who creates most of our ebooks now?
Yep, exactly. And
so
we had a customer.
Well-earned props to Unum. And well-earned props, we have an amazing customer. They're called the Rodon Group. Now, you may be familiar with Kinect Toys. Mm. They are a sister company to the Kinect Toy Company. Back in the fall, I had the privilege of going down to see their factory in Hatfield, Pennsylvania, because President Barack Obama chose it as the platform where he was going to speak and announce a major policy. How did they get on the White House's radar? Well, Marketing Sherpa this week has a B2B marketing case study on their Cheaper Than China branding campaign. They increased sales by 33% by this inbound marketing campaign. We're very proud to have been the software platform they used to do it, but it was really an amazing piece of work. So congratulations to the team down at the Rodon Group, and thanks for being a HubSpot customer.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for watching or listening, because we're now on audio only as well. Multiple ways to subscribe to Marketing Update, and we look forward to interacting with you next week.
Let us know what you think. I am at Pistachio on the Twitters, and he is at M. Volpe.
You've got it.